This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The bigger picture on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Live and Learn. Singapore, which prides itself on strong law and order, is cutting off online access for government workers from about 100,000 computers. Access on their private devices is fine, but this internet access on the government devices will be restricted from May next year. We're discussing security on the internet today. Keith Rosario, a tech blogger in the studio with me. How are you today, Keith?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Fantastic. What did you think about Singapore's move to, you know, isolate 100,000 computers?
Yeah. You shouldn't use the word access, you should use the word connectivity. It's a bit more apt, I think.
Okay.
I can't speak like from this connected nation sort of perspective or employee morale, but from a security perspective, just look at it from a security perspective, it is 100% a good idea.
Why is that? Because the reason I'm asking you, Keith, is because according to the Asia-Pacific Defense Outlook 2016, five countries, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and Singapore, have been dubbed the Cyber Five. They appear 9 times more vulnerable for cyber attacks. Yeah. Why?
Well, is the US on that list? It should be number one, actually.
Yeah, so it looks like pretty much this side of the world, really.
Why is it number one? Because it's connected. Connectivity brings with it all the good stuff, you know, all the stuff that you get to do. You get to buy your plane tickets online, all that. It also brings all the bad stuff. You can't get one without the other. It's a two-for-one deal sort of thing, right? So the US, for example, very, very vulnerable to cyber attack simply because they've got a lot of stuff online. North Korea, not so much vulnerable because they got nothing online. So if the US and North Korea went to war, you know, North Korea wins the cyber war every time because it can always take a punch. You can take down all of their cyber infrastructure. Country doesn't realize it's offline.
Yeah.
But if you take down the US infrastructure, you know, it goes offline. So the more connected you are, the more vulnerable you are.
But it's interesting because China and India seem to be less vulnerable. And they are the most populous nations in the region.
Yeah, China have this the Great Firewall, if you heard about it. So they've got some things. They've thought about some things already. They block Facebook and Twitter and all the stuff. A lot of things people think is just for propaganda. But what that does is it allows the Chinese government to keep these, you know, the Sina Weibo, the two equivalents of them in country, you know, well within, you know, the Chinese government's control, but also keeps a lot of the net traffic within the country. Right, so it prevents sort of outside attackers to coming in. That the Great Firewall is a big sort of blockade that it can do. So it's quite interesting. Again, it's like you shouldn't ask yourself, well, the connectivity brings with it bad stuff and good stuff. What you should ask yourself is that this move from the government makes their infrastructure more secure. It's without question, yeah, without question. But whether that increase in security is worth the increase in inconvenience it's going to bring to the staff and to the government services, I think the jury's still out on that one. I'm not sure. But that's how you should look at it. It's a trade-off. You get the good stuff and the bad stuff, and if you're willing to, say, block off all internet connectivity, which is like the thermonuclear solution to the problem, what do you get in return? And I think the Singaporean government's thinking, well, we get a lot of security in return.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think it should be across all civil servants or just... I mean, you got teachers, for an example, who may seem harmless.
If I read correctly, I think the teachers are exempted from the rule.
Okay.
So and that's because the teachers are not on the government network. So they've got their own thing. And the most, you know, maybe a teacher gets ransomware and then one small classroom in Singapore has to retake their exam. not that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're connected to that government network and access to all of this government data, then you get cut off. Not all civil servants are going to get hit by this equally, right? Because the frontline staff, the people that you deal with on a daily basis when you go to LHDN or you go to the immigration department, they don't have internet connectivity on that front line on their computers anyway. So the ruling would not affect them. But you go a few layers behind in the organization, in the government, you get people doing, you know, what everybody else does on a daily basis.
Facebooking.
You know? Facebooking, PowerPoint slides, spreadsheets. And I think those people are going to be the hardest hit.
Yeah.
Not because they can't access Facebook, but, you know, you use the internet for your work, right? For your research, you know, sometimes like even trivial things like how do I do VLOOKUP on a spreadsheet?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then if you don't have the internet and you got to whip out your phone, you got to figure it out, you know, it's inconvenient. It's not undoable, it is inconvenient. But those people are going to be the hardest hit. So I think what the government has done, and this is what I read, so because they have this thing where they say, we'll do this and then we'll recalibrate as we go along. So we block off everybody, and depending on how much noise comes out of the system, how much productivity hit we take, then we may loosen up a couple of screws here and there, we may give some. And then you end up in a much higher state of security.
Okay, so it's a good step in the right direction, in your opinion.
Yes.
Given that Singapore is considered one of the cyber five as well, in the Asia-Pacific region.
Maybe Asia-Pacific, so that's why America was... yes, I think so it's without doubt. So something we have to realize about the data that the government has on you, right? If you lose your credit card, the bank has a process to issue you a new one. It's a bit later, a bit mafan, you have to call people and get, you know, your direct debit, your Astro billing of the change, but it can be done. If I post your IC number online with your picture and your address, there is nothing the government can do. It doesn't have a process to issue you a new IC number. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's basically the data that the government has on you is in many cases far more important than what the banks have on you. And you got to protect it. They have to protect it. And I get a bit peeved when people give out the IC number so freely.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, you go to...
Why do you think we do that? I mean, back in the day, so particular about, you know, we have a file for our documents.
Yeah.
But now we have no problem revealing this information.
Exactly. So you go to a shopping mall and the guy tells you, apply for the credit card, just give me your data. You know, you don't even have to use it. You can cancel it when you get it and I'll give you this $50 Jusco voucher, you know. But what you're actually giving him is your IC number, your address, a little bit of your income information, a lot of that data. It's worth more than 50 ringgit. The banks aren't stupid. Right? Yeah. So, I mean, coming back to the point, it's a bit of a digression, but coming back to the point is that some of the data that the government has on you is basically cast in stone. If they lose it, and governments have lost this, okay, so in this year alone, you've seen two attacks. The Turkish government lost about 50 million records. The Filipino Election Commission lost about 20 plus million. Singapore's a country of 5 million. So it's like five times the size of Singapore. And it's going to happen more and more, I think. Okay. So we should be a bit more concerned about the people who are the custodians of this information.
Of course. We are discussing cyber attacks. If you have a question, we've opened up the phone lines. Give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. We'll definitely ask the question about passwords and how many of us actually have one password for a million accounts. But where do you draw the line? Keith, if everyone is a disconnect, how do they even work together? And if they do work together, how are they then going to move the work to anyone else? And then are they going to print it out?
Yep.
Is the printer secure? Is the paper secure? I mean, where does this stop? Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, so the government has blocked internet connectivity. But the internet's not the only network. It's the biggest network, of course, but it's not the only network. So normally within an organization sufficiently large, they have the intranet of the organization. So they still have email access on their government machines, so they still be able to send and receive emails to anyone in the public. So you've got some way of communicating. But you're right. So the moment you shut down the corporate intranet, the moment you shut down people's emails and laptops and everything else, everything just grinds to a halt. The modern workplace can't work without computers. I guess they've drawn the line somewhere. They said, okay, you get to have emails. I'm not particularly clear how they differentiate between work emails and personal emails. They've made some distinction there. And they say, well, if you want to have internet, we'll have these kiosks where you can go and log on. And if you find something interesting, you can email it to yourself and use it on the machine sort of thing. It's going to be inconvenient.
Okay. And why do people target government information? Do you aren't the firewalls and all of that enough?
No. I mean, we've seen so many things, right? So we've seen, you remember about the $1 billion hack from the Bangladeshi Central Bank?
Why don't you give us some background?
Yeah, so the Bangladeshi Central Bank got hacked, and these guys were smart enough to know how to hack into the bank, smart enough to know how to route SWIFT messages. It's how you sort of transfer money across. Smart enough to know that, you know, these particular casinos in the Philippines have got some lax money laundering laws. You know, these are smart, smart people. But you also have... Not so
smart.
Aren't
they doing
people.
A good thing, like revealing all these activities, which are not supposed to be happening?
Who's revealing the good things?
The hackers.
Yeah, the hackers. well, these guys are not doing it for the noble cause of education, but they're of course, they're really. The more we know about this, the better prepared we can be for future attacks, right? But hacking, just like any other criminal activity, is essentially a business, right? You have to make money at the end of the day. If you can't make money from it, there's no point doing it. The government is the single custodian for data on all citizens. The only entity that has data for every Malaysian citizen is the Malaysian government, and vice versa for any other government in the world. So if you want to go for personal data, go to the motherload. So that's where the money is, so to speak. That's where the data is, right? We've seen lots of types of attacks. So the Philippines Election Commission attack that I talked about earlier, that was done by some 23-year-old fresh graduate. So doesn't exactly speak well of the Election Commission, but okay. The Turkish guys, we don't really know. We think it's an Icelandic group. This Swift attack from the Bangladeshi bank, that one was really, really sophisticated. And the one that I didn't mention yet was the biggest one, actually. I think it's called the Office of Personal Management. It's the entity that has all the data on federal government employees of the U.S. government. Yeah, so we think that the Chinese government got their hands on that. So you can't download that. You can download the Turkish government hack. You can download the Philippines Election Commission hack. You can't download the OPM data. That I think the Chinese government are keeping it. So they have like 20 million accounts of wow. U.S. federal employees, you know. Apalagi China Mao. So it's like, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. So yeah. So you were saying firewalls, antivirus software. Is this all being done on a very much higher sophisticated level that people like you and I shouldn't really have to worry too much about?
If I told you like you had to play badminton with Dato Lee Chong Wei today, right? There's no advice anyone in the world can give you on how to beat him, because just the gap in skills is just way too big, right?
Yep.
The same way if a well-skilled hacker was out to get you, if the US NSA was out to get you, there's no advice anyone in the world can tell you other than disconnect yourself from the internet and go live in a cave to protect you. The only reason the NSA hasn't hacked you is you don't appear high enough on their priority list, you know, to hack into. So sort of thing. So there's two parts of it. One is that the really sophisticated guys, they are out targeting, you know, more valuable people than myself and my little bank account. But you also got these other guys, which are sort of like these big criminal organizations that sort of cull from the bottom. They go out there and in the similar ways of the Nigerian scam, you know, the one, my father died with $12 billion, yes. Give me $100,000 and I'll give you all sort of thing. They send out emails. They blast out hundreds of thousands of emails and maybe 1% of people reply and maybe 1% of people give them money. But that's enough because the cost of sending emails is just too low. But the people that reply are the, let's say, the most vulnerable in society, the most gullible, the people that really want to believe and that sort of thing. So it's the same thing on a cyber state. So you have... there are some actors where no amount of security is going to protect you from them, right? We probably don't have to worry about those guys. But there's a whole bunch of other people who are just blasting out attacks. And what you want to do is just rise a little bit above everybody else so that you don't get cut off in the process.
Okay, yeah. All right then. And do you think we're doing enough here in Malaysia?
I think we're not doing enough anywhere in the world, to be honest. I think the criminals are having a field day.
How do you get ahead of them? They're always going to be ahead
of
you.
Yeah, it's like a competitive game, right? It's a good guys and bad guys. And to answer your question about the antiviruses, there are, you know, so the antiviruses and the bad guys, they're sort of like in this competition. Sometimes they come out on top and sometimes they don't. You can't win all the time, right? So you may have an antivirus that protects you from most viruses and malware, but not all, you know. Somebody somewhere is going to figure out a way to bypass those checks. Having a good antivirus is like driving a Volvo, you know. It's a safe car, you know. You can feel reasonably safe in it, but that doesn't give you license to, you know, drive it 200 kilometers above the speed limit while drinking Johnny Walker in one hand, that sort of thing, right? So you still got to take precautions. Yeah.
Okay. And can we learn anything from how banks limit internet access to certain employees, for an example? Because it's already happening in the military field and the banking arena.
Yeah, so that's where I think we'll end up as a sort of like a stable state where you'd say, well, this everybody has no internet, maybe a bit too, you know, far off the spectrum. You'll sort of bring it back a little bit and let certain people in the organization have some sort of internet access. I think it's going to end up there, but we'll have to see.
Okay. We're discussing cyber attacks. Singapore is going to cut off internet or access.
Yeah,
am
internet.
I correct?
Interconnectivity
amongst civil servants. About 100,000 computers are going to be affected. And they'll be restricted from May next year. They'll be all right with their private devices. That's all right. But it's only the government devices. devices. But on the same week, it was also revealed that a few of Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's social media accounts were hacked due to his low security password. Now, is Zuckerberg equivalent to you and I? I don't know. I mean,
his bank account has a lot more zeros.
Yes.
Than mine, yeah,
so. That's true. Okay, we're discussing this. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000.
Income tax paid each year is important to the country in achieving Vision 2020, hence ensuring the well-being of all citizens. Carry out your tax responsibility by completing and submitting your B-2015 income tax return form from now till 30th June 2016. Income tax matters can be done online. It's easy, accurate and secure. Use e-filing to complete and submit your income tax. Pay your remaining tax, if any, through via Hasil. Find out more at www.hasil.gov.my.
Is this too excessive, and can you think of more meaningful ways to spend that money?
Is the Islamic bureaucracy in line with the provisions afforded under the federal constitution?
Why are there so many special branch officers? Is this again an example of the politicization of our police?
Did you have a fallout with Tun Mahathir?
Good question.
The Breakfast Grill. We get the answers you want. Weekdays at 8 a.m. Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon, it's Live and Learn, and I'm Mira Sivasothi. Keith Rosario, a tech blogger in the studio with me, helping me understand security on the internet. May sound rather lame, but you know what? Singapore's taken a big move. Singapore, according to the Asia Pacific Defense Outlook 2016, is one of the cyber five. They appear nine times more vulnerable to cyber attacks, and so Singapore has made the decision to cut off online access for government workers from about 100,000 computers starting May next year. If you have a question, our phone lines are open. It's 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Keith, on the same week, Mark Zuckerberg, his social media accounts were hacked because of low security password. I understand one of his social media accounts' password was supposedly da da da. Yeah. I mean, that's got to be fatherhood getting to him. but what did yeah. I mean, what did you think? I mean, what do you think of passwords and how we select passwords?
Yeah, a lot of people don't do a very good job. I mean, why does Mark Zuckerberg have a LinkedIn account anyway? So he's like thinking, maybe this Facebook thing isn't going to work out. Better build my professional network.
Maybe. Maybe. Perhaps, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, so here's what I think is that this was some account he opened just for fun, just to see how it is. It's actually breached from a LinkedIn account, right? So LinkedIn had a big breach 4 years ago, actually, but we're only seeing the data now. And what hackers have done is they've taken that breach, they looked at Mark Zuckerberg, they figured out his password was da-da-da. It's a very, very bad password. It's like a,
no, I'm telling you, it's fatherhood.
It's fatherhood. Yeah. And they tried it on Twitter and Pinterest. And I think they got into Twitter and Pinterest. So this group is, I forgot what it was called The Mine, I think. It's a Saudi Arabian group. So it's, again, it's a huge conglomeration. Everybody's getting in on the act.
Okay.
Not a big deal because Mark Zuckerberg doesn't really use his Twitter and LinkedIn very often. So that's okay. But it's a lesson for all of us. He didn't do three things. He used a weak password, so you should use a strong password. He reused his passwords across LinkedIn, Twitter, and Pinterest. You should never do that. And he didn't turn on two-factor authentication. So if you want to avoid being owned like Mark Zuckerberg, you should at least do these three things. Use a strong password. We'll get to that in a bit. Don't reuse your password and use two-factor authentication wherever possible.
Okay, what do you mean by a strong password?
Yeah, so I have to take a little bit of a detour, if you don't mind.
Sure, yeah. Take your time. We're all victims, potential victims here.
So in computer science, right, we have this thing called a one-way hash. It's a wonderful mathematical function, and some of you listeners have already dropped off at this point. But it's this great thing. It's like the Jalan Sahala of mathematical functions. Numbers go in, they don't go back, right? So if I take a word like da-da-da, and I push it through this hash function, I get an output. Let's say the output is X. From that value of X, I can't figure out da-da-da anymore. I've lost information and it's been hashed. That's why it's called one-way, right? And what is stored in the databases of systems is the value X. It's not da-da-da. So it's important to know this. Because what happens is when people break into LinkedIn or any other system, they get all the passwords. They don't actually get the passwords. They get the hashes of the passwords. So they get the X, not the da-da-da. Right? If all they stored was da-da-da, then whether you use da-da-da or you use the 65-character-long password with symbols and numbers, everything else, it still wouldn't be. There would be no concept of weak and strong password because it will all be in the plane. Everybody gets to see it. But what happens is the hackers get the value X, and now they've got to figure out, so Mark Zuckerberg's password hashes to the value X, what was X? And they sort of guess. They guess, they go, they try, you know, ABC123, ABC1234, ABC1345, and they just go on and on and just try and guessing. You can set up, you know, your sort of password guesser if you like. For $100, you can set up a password guesser that can guess about 1 billion guesses a second.
Wow.
Right, 1 billion guesses a second. The English language has about 1 million words. That's about it. So 1 billion guesses a second means that if your password was an English word, I'd guess it in 1/1000th of a second.
Wow.
That's about as much security as you get, 1 millisecond. That's how much security you have. So what you need to do to make a strong password is to have a password that's, you know, has enough randomness. The word we use is entropy, but, you know, it's just a bunch of googly gook that means that if someone's about to guess your password, it'll be like a 1 in quadrillion possibility. 1 in billions is not enough. You need to go to a quadrillion. So you need to go like from, you know, 8-character passwords that you probably have today, you need to go to something like 12 or 14 characters. That's how far you need to go in order to stay ahead of these guys. Right, so that when the hackers get these huge password breaches of, you know, 12 million passwords, the first passwords to get broken are people who use da-da-da, the people who use 6-character passwords, people who use the word password. They think they're being smart, you know. If I use the word password, no one's going to guess, you know. But no, that is actually the most used password of all time. So don't try and do that, you know. That's the first thing people choose. So anything that's the first line, that those people get hacked the first. At least you with your 12, 14-character password, you're going to be a little bit safer. You're going to have a little bit more time to go and change some passwords and, you know, secure your account. Sort of
thing. Which brings me to, how often do you need to change that password?
Yeah.
Man, this is hard work remembering everything.
This is the problem I have. So, no, you should never change it. You should, let me rephrase that. A lot of people say that you should change your password on a constant basis, right? Mm-hmm. These people are wrong. So,
Thank God.
Yeah, you should never. What you shouldn't do is you shouldn't reuse your password. So if you got a password on LinkedIn, don't make it the same as your Twitter, don't make it the same as Pinterest. Your Maybank to you password shouldn't be the same as your Maxis logon password. All of that has to be different. So that if someone hacked one system, that exposure doesn't spill onto the other services, right? So that's what you should do. But once you have passwords for these systems, you don't need to change them on a constant basis. In fact, what we find is that if you force people to change, they choose passwords like Alakazam. And then when they change it, they go to Alakazam 1 and Alakazam 2 and Alakazam 3. So if I figured out your password was Alakazam 3, it's not a very tall hurdle to figure out what your next password is going to be. The idea that people have is if you change your password on a constant basis, what happens is the hackers who come in, and then when you change your passwords, the hackers get locked out. No, that's not how it works. You know, the hackers who come in when they're completely in control of your system, doesn't matter how often you change. You can't change your password every day or every week. So at the most, like, you can change your password every month, maybe every 30 days. 30 days is more than enough time for a hacker to completely own your system, own your entire network, do a lot of stuff. Phineas Fisher was a hacker who hacked into Hacking Team, right? And he wrote a whole DIY, how I did it sort of thing. Or she, we don't know who they are, and can't be, you know, sexist, yeah? You know? But they wrote a DIY, and they managed to hack into this specialized company that sells spyware to governments in 100 hours. So your 30-day password change policy is not going to help. Like, come on, it's like bringing a knife to a gunfight.
Okay.
it's the wrong thing to do.
Sure.
Yeah.
And the third one,
yeah.
Strong password, don't reuse.
Yes.
And the third one?
Two-factor authentication.
What is that?
So a factor is either something you know. So a password is something you know, and they can verify this. It can also be something that you have. So when you withdraw money from the ATM, that's a two-factor authentication. You have your ATM card, mm-hmm. and you have your PIN. You know your PIN, so yep. It's two. Or it can be something that you are. So either your biometrics, a thumbprint, iris scan, that sort of thing. When you use one factor, it usually means you're just using a password, right? If you have two-factor, what happens is when you log on to Twitter, Twitter will actually ask you for a code that only your phone has. So you prove that I know the password, one factor, and I have my phone, second factor. It's the same thing when you do online banking, you transfer to a new account, so you know the password to log on to the account and do the transfer. But before the transfer gets executed, and the bank sends you a TAC code on your phone, so you prove that I know the password and I have my phone. When you involve two factors, it's much, much harder to hack than if you involve one. If Mark Zuckerberg used two-factor for his Pinterest and his Twitter account, what would happen is the hackers would still figure out his password is da-da-da, but they wouldn't be able to access his account because the Twitter would have asked them for the second factor and they wouldn't have been able to provide it.
Okay. Yeah. So do you think in most situations there is a two-factor authentication process?
Yes. So Google, Twitter, most of the big companies have it. You know, nowadays almost everybody has two-factor by default. Yeah.
Okay. So there's no system that's foolproof, really.
Yes. Yeah, and there's no such thing.
It doesn't exist at all.
It's like a house that's completely burglar-proof is a house without any doors. But it's quite a useless house. Right? Nobody can get in or can get out. The moment you open a door for people to get in and get out, you open the door for the thieves to get in and get out. So there's no such thing as a foolproof connected system.
Yeah. You enjoy your work, don't you?
I do.
Very much. It's a whole lot of fun. I don't like the trying to understand the X factor, but it must be quite interesting.
Yes.
Policing. We step up policing in response to increasing crime. Yes. Should we even bother if that's the case?
Oh, this is an interesting question. Because of the international nature of cybercrime, it's a bit more difficult than just stepping up policing, right? If someone were to kidnap your child and ask you for ransom for it, the police are obligated to help you get them back. But if someone were to install ransomware in your machine and completely encrypt all your files and say that pay me some money to get your data back, what can the police do? The guys who are doing it are probably in Russia somewhere. You know, how it's the same thing we have with these, you know, the kidnapping in Busayev kidnappers in southern Philippines. It's the same sort of, you know, you're crossing a lot of borders, and in many cases you don't even know where the jurisdictions of these guys who are doing it. And that's the hard part, because you can step up policing, but what do you really expect the police to do, sort of thing? So you should, and we often rely on the police for defending us, right? But in this case, it's more of a wild, wild west, every man for himself sort
of thing. Absolutely. Yeah. So you just need to be empowered and do as much as you can on a personal level. Because you can't really depend on anyone else. So do you think it's sophisticated criminals, or is it just like our attitude, which is so lax when it comes to hacking?
It's both.
It's
a pretty bad decision. When you have a sophisticated criminal organization and ecosystem, and you have a whole bunch of people who are not taking any precautions, it's a candy store.
Of course. So it's a bit of both.
Yes.
Brian Ng is asking, does Window Defender keep our machines safe from viruses and hackers?
So I think Windows Defender is the generic Microsoft antivirus you get with Windows. It's as good as any other antivirus as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, it's good. It's better than not having an antivirus, but it doesn't give you absolute protection. You should never work on the false assumption that this is absolutely secure.
Yeah. Another question. How do you evaluate the effectiveness of a virus software?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. You go and get reviews, and a whole bunch of guys will take a whole bunch of malware, push it through a whole bunch of viruses, and see what's the hit rate, right? So if you can find 99% of my viruses, you're good. But it still means that 1% went through. It still means that people can obviously write software tailored to avoid detection. In fact, you can go online today if you have some Bitcoin and are criminally inclined, write a piece of software and submit it to these guys, who will actually tweak a little bit of your program here and there so that it avoids detection by all antiviruses. It's called fully undetectable.
Yeah.
And that's why antiviruses don't really do as much as they claim they do. It's still better than not having one. You still need to have one, but it doesn't give you absolute protection.
Okay, so what do we do really at the end of the day?
Yeah, it's actually a long laundry list of things you have to do. But it's like, if you tell me to exercise and eat right and give me a whole laundry list, probably won't do it. So if you could just do one thing, don't need to be so lazy, just do one thing, right? Mm-hmm. Go back home or wherever you are, turn on two-factor for your primary email account. So your primary email account most probably is Gmail. A lot of people use Gmail.
Yes.
You turn on two-factor for that. The reason why is because if you lose control of any account, usually what they do is they can send you a reset password to your email account, right? But if you lose control of your email account, then everything sort of falls apart from there. So at least secure your Gmail. At least put two-factor for the Gmail. It's better than nothing. And it gives you actually a lot of security. It's the most bang for buck move you can do at this point in time.
Okay, fantastic. And just going back to Singapore and segmenting of the internet access, what are your thoughts on that? Would you like to leave us with something? Does segmenting mean that you're free from hackers?
Well, there's nothing that means free from hackers. We didn't cover how, in my community, in the, like the techie community, right, we have this thing called Stuxnet. This is like a folklore mythology kind of thing. It's the first cyber weapon we know of, right? It was developed by the Americans and Israelis to attack Iranians, etc. But the facility that they attacked was a nuclear facility that had no network connection going in, no network connection coming out. But they still managed to attack it. They still managed to destroy nuclear centrifuges, you know, that sort of thing. So there's
no internet access.
No internet access. All they had was engineers walking in with laptops. They managed to, as we think, they managed to infect one of the laptops. The laptop went in, infected a little bit of network inside, and managed to you know, destroy nuclear centrifuges, that sort of thing. Basically, it comes back to the point that the Americans want to get you, they're going to get you. There's nothing you can do to sort of stop that. But if you segment out your network, if you block internet access, if you do these sorts of things, it makes it much, much harder. If Nantans was connected to the internet, which it wasn't, but if it was, it would be a whole lot easier.
Would you say then China is ahead of the game? It seems like it.
It's hard to say. I think they had this big agreement, I can't remember, I think end of last year, between President Obama and President Xi, that they will not hack for commercial purposes. They will still hack for, you know, foreign relations, sort of espionage purposes, but they won't hack for commercial purposes. So it's hard to say who's got the upper hand here, but it's an exciting time to sort of look around. Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Would you have a message in general on security on the internet?
No, I guess go back to doing two-factor for Gmail. Do that one thing, just that one thing. That's all I'm asking for. If you do that, it's okay.
Two-factor authentication process for Gmail.
Yes. That's all I'm asking.
Great advice, Keith. Go back and do that today for your Gmail account. That was Keith Rosario, a tech blogger, talking to us about security on the internet on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.